So the title of today's talk is Correspondences in Nature and the Power of Thinking in Analogies. And this will be again part of my Patana series. And it is a talk about the Patana condition of Anyamanya Paccayo, which I personally translate as sometimes as correspondence, sometimes as analogy. Now, usually the word correspondences evokes more pictures about material things, I would say, while an analogy refers more to something like two ideas relating to each other. So, but as I will try to make clear in this talk, both refer to the same principle. So actually the more literal translation of the Pali word anyamanya would be something like one thing relating to another. So often it is translated as mutuality condition. But I personally prefer to translate it as condition of correspondence or of analogy. So, and like with all talks on the Patana, I again will try to relate this condition, or I want to show that this condition of things relating to each other in a certain way exists in relation to all the four paramattas: matter, mind, consciousness, and nirvana. And now I will try to do my best to make this talk a talk that can stand by itself. So, but otherwise I would recommend any listener to also listen to my talk on the basics of Buddhist philosophy and Patana, the grammar of insight, or to read my book Paramatta, in which I go much more into the depth of Abhidhamma philosophy. So, but now let me start. So, in order to properly grasp what I mean with the condition of correspondence, perhaps the most simple image that I would like to put into the mind of the listener is the image of how our analog clock. Now, most people have digital clocks, but everyone still knows the analog clock, which has a direct correspondence to the position of the sun relative to the person who looks onto the watch or onto the clock. So if both hands of the clock point upwards, then usually that corresponds to a position of the sun being at the highest point in heaven or in the sky. So now this is one condition of correspondence that most of us are very familiar with. But then going more into Buddhist topics, let's think of this condition in relation to the four primary elements that are frequently talked about in Buddhist scriptures, but which existed as a basic classification system for matter basically around the world and in almost all cultures. So in Buddhist scriptures, we often find these statements that the Buddha made, or sometimes some of his disciples made, that just as there exist the forest fires and winds and rivers and oceans in the outside world, equally so there exists a fire element, a water element, a wind element, and an earth element within our body. So this is very relevant for the meditator, because if you learn to correlate what you perceive with your eyes with what you perceive in meditation when feeling into your body, then because human beings are very visual beings, you have a whole world. Now, most of your knowledge constitutes usually two things: revolving around what can be seen. So if you can make use of the knowledge you have about this world that mostly can be seen, and if you can relate it to the world that you feel when meditating, now then you can take a lot of knowledge into your meditation and you can gain a lot of insight into the nature of reality by meditating, by perceiving things inside your body and relating it to the knowledge that you have about how the cosmos is constituted. So I hope the listener can see that this is a very helpful thing for meditation, to know that there are correspondences between the inner world and the outer world. So whatever you find out about the outer world, or whatever you already know about the outer world, you can take into your meditation. You can try to relate whatever you already know to what you experience within yourself, within your meditation. And then you're not so much groping blindly only in the dark. So these are kind of two examples of how this condition can be seen to exist in the sphere of matter. One is the sun in relation to our clock and in relation to our perception of day and night. And the other is the four elements. If you meditate about this condition and this idea more deeply, you will find there are so many examples of how this condition can be perceived in the sphere of matter. So, but maybe for this talk, this is enough for the sphere of matter. So let me go on to the sphere of mind and show how this condition can be found in the sphere of mind. Now, when we talk about mind, usually what we have in mind is mind states like anger or greed or joy or love. No, states of mind, basically. And it is a very helpful thing for a meditator if he is able to identify, now greed has arisen in my mind, now my mind is concentrated, now my mind is peaceful, now I am angry. To know that is a form of wisdom, is a form of self-knowledge. But if you want to meditate like for a long time, like for many years, and we really want to go deeper into understanding what this thing called mind is, then usually we want to broaden our understanding of the mind. And one way of doing that, which is for many people very natural, especially religiously inclined people will intuitively usually understand this fact, at least to some degree, which is that certain mind states which we might witness in ourselves or in others have a certain correspondence to the descriptions of hell and demons and heaven and gods and angels, devas. Now, there exists a certain correspondence between mind states that we know of and that we have already witnessed either within ourselves or within others, and these planes of existence that spiritual cosmology often talks about. So usually it is not that every mind state that we experience within ourselves we will be able to relate either to heaven or to hell, because certain mind states are what we might call purely human. So it's only when our mind really becomes refined and purified and lofty, then we might experience within ourselves mind states that we feel they are really divine. No, they give us some insight about how heaven might look like. And now we might realize that they are so uncommon in human life that they are appropriately placed in a cosmology above humans and above human life. Well, on the other side of the spectrum, and hopefully if we are meditators or kind of religious practitioners, we don't witness such mind states too often within ourselves, but the mind states of strong vengefulness, strong hatred, sometimes if we perceive them in others, at least. Sometimes we might experience them within ourselves, but these are usually the mind states that when they arise within ourselves, we tend to not want to look within ourselves. We tend to look rather without. So these mind states are especially much easier to identify without ourselves, because there are stronger mind states which are rather difficult to detach from. But now, if we detach from them, either within ourselves or when perceiving them without in others, now sometimes we might get something like perceptions of that there's a little demon in that person. And often you can see it in the facial expression when a person is really angry, really full of hate, and really in very coarse states of mind. His face often becomes very ugly and often really quite demonic. So, and this can give you some insight into this spiritual cosmology. And when you have ever realized that your body and your mind are not exactly the same thing. Now, usually they are interconnected and one reacts to the other and is intricately bound up with the other. But especially in states of meditation, you may be able to get experiences where your mind is utterly detached from your body, or where you lose all perception of your body. And these are the mind states where you begin to realize that mind and body are not exactly the same thing. And when you become aware of that mind and body are not the same thing, then you might wonder what will happen when your body disappears, when your body dies. So, and if you have been observant, or if you become observant after such realization, you will begin to realize that there's a lot to this idea that a person of really evil mind will go to hell or will go to a very dark place. Now, he will be attracted to darkness, to dark places, and to dark beings. Now, especially when he is not anymore perpetually reminded by the fear of the senses of the human life and the positive aspects of existence and sunlight and so on. Now, he will be drawn more and more into the sphere of darkness. While on the other hand side, the person of a pure heart, now you will just realize this is just the mechanics, that once his body would fall away, now when he dies or in a condition of meditation, now you will see it's just the natural dynamic of things, the natural mechanics of things, that he will be attracted to the light and he will feel that his rightful place is in the sphere of light and in the sphere of heaven and amongst lofty beings without earthly concerns. So this is how our mind states correspond to the cosmos, correspond to the planes of existence that exist in the spiritual cosmos, we can say, in the cosmos that is not just matter, not just the material universe. So, and this understanding can be very helpful for insight meditation. Like, it can be very helpful for understanding our place in the universe. It can be very helpful for understanding where we are heading with our meditation, with our actions, with our speech, and with how we conduct ourselves in the world and with our mind in our meditation. But then there's also another way of thinking about the mind or about consciousness in relation to this condition. Now, when I say mind or consciousness, the thing with these two is that they are very difficult to treat apart entirely, because mind and consciousness usually form something like a unity. So, but when I say mind, what I mean with that is usually mind states or emotions. While when I talk about consciousness, I usually mean either one's individual way of perceiving the world, not what we often think of as individuality. Now, because individuality is kind of at the core of consciousness. Everyone basically perceives a different world. Now, for similar species, now the individuals of a certain species usually perceive the world in quite a similar manner. But still, each individual somewhat perceives the world in his own individual way. So this relates to what I said before about the planes of existence. The second way of thinking about consciousness is thinking of it in matters of what is technically called the mental process, which is a division of consciousness into different phases or into different degrees of intensity. Now, from utter unconsciousness to who knows the limit of how conscious a person can be. So, but in regard to this, we can also find many correspondences related to that. For example, let us take one day-night cycle of a human being, beginning with before we wake up. Now, the first point kind of is we are in a condition of deep dreamless sleep where we are entirely unconscious. Then gradually, usually before we wake up, we experience some amount of dreams, wherein consciousness gains greater intensity. Consciousness comes to life, we can say. Or consciousness begins to vibrate. Then when we wake up, we begin to perceive the first sense impressions. In the early morning, it might be the light coming through the windows, or the alarm clock, or the chirping of the birds, etc. And the first, when we are not yet fully conscious, we might kind of investigate first, what is this sound? What is this light? And then slowly we realize, oh, this is sunlight coming through my window. Or, oh, this is the sound of my alarm clock, etc. And then slowly thinking begins. And once thinking begins, we are beginning to draw into the present moment our whole story of who we are, of what is the next thing we have to do. And this is how our day begins. And principally, we can say that perhaps not with the progression of the day, consciousness intensifies and thought processes intensify, until at the end of the day, again, thought processes and consciousness slowly begin to diminish until we go back again into a condition of utter unconsciousness. Now, this is one day-night cycle, we can say. But actually, throughout the day, we go through this in a minor manner, in a small manner, every minute. every minute or every few minutes, depending on how old we are, depending on how mature we are, how developed we are. There are degrees as to how long we might have sustained mental processes or how often we go back into a condition of unconsciousness. But still, for every person, every minute or every few minutes, he will cycle through conditions of greater consciousness to conditions often of utter unconsciousness. So there are small cycles in bigger cycles. But this does not stop with one day-night cycle, because actually our whole life equally can be viewed in this way. Because when we are born, or before we are born even, we are in a condition for the most part of utter unconsciousness. There might off and on arise some sense impression, but for the most part, in the early period of our existence, we are for the most part unconscious. A baby is mostly sleeping. Then gradually, as we grow older, we begin to perceive more and more sense impressions. We more and more come into contact with the world. We are more and more hit by the world. Then, as we develop, we begin to investigate those sense impressions. Then we name them, we give names to them, we learn names for them. And then gradually, as we grow older, when we have more and more names for the things surrounding us, we begin to think more and more. And that principally, in a kind of ideal manner, we can say, that increases until the peak of life is reached. And after the peak of life is reached, then gradually it begins to diminish again. Until at the point of death, we are again at a condition of utter unconsciousness.
These are three mental phenomena of different magnitude, which are perfectly correlated with each other. Momentary mental phenomena, daily mental phenomena, and the mind spread out over the whole life, we can say. So if we find out something about one of them, we can make deductions about the rest of them. Then finally, we have as the last category of mind, the category of ideas. And there too, at least ideally, we can find correspondences. Because if we have ideas which correspond to reality, then that is usually called wisdom, or at least intelligence. While if we have ideas which entirely do not correspond in any way with reality, that is usually called delusion. So if we want to be a wise person, or at least an intelligent person, we should always try to check if whatever knowledge we have acquired, whatever ideas we have arising in our mind, whether it corresponds to reality or whether it doesn't. So that much about mind, matter, and consciousness. But then correspondences can be even found in relation to the sphere of nirvana, the ultimate of nirvana, which can be very helpful for understanding where we want to go or where we should be going. So in the first instance, we may see that there's a certain correspondence between understanding these previous three paramita of matter, mind, and consciousness and the progress one makes on the path to enlightenment or on the path of enlightenment. So in Buddhism, the path to enlightenment or the path to full enlightenment is divided into four stages, from the stream enterer to the arahat. And we can see that there's a certain correspondence between the first stage of enlightenment of the stream enterer and a certain rough understanding of at least the sphere of matter, understanding that it is imperfect, impermanent, and bound up with suffering. So this understanding is directly related with the first stage of enlightenment. And then with the next two stages of enlightenment, we can see that there's a direct correspondence between an understanding of mind and consciousness and progressing through these stages. While a person who is fully enlightened or a person who attains final nirvana will be entirely free from the sphere of matter, mind and consciousness. He will have entirely realized their impermanent, imperfect and suffering nature. So this is one way we can think of the condition of correspondence in relation to nirvana. But then there's another way, in that the experience, the personal individual experience of nirvana within, has a direct correspondence to some reality without. Sometimes it's referred to as nirvana dhatu, sometimes it's referred to the deathless or the deathless element. So, but there's always a correspondence between the within and the without. And if the within has apparently no correspondence whatsoever with anything without, that's what we call delusion. Then a person is entirely in his own fantasy world, which has no correspondence whatsoever with anything. So that is not the path to enlightenment. The path to enlightenment is about realizing the nature of existence. And that comes about through thinking in a way that accords with existence and that accords with reality. So, and yeah, that may be how we can see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, to use the words of, I believe, William Blake. And maybe too, how we can see the span of a life in a moment's duration and the meaning of enlightenment in the world of conditions. And that may be a good closing word, I feel.